This is Squawk Pod. I'm CNBC producer Katie Kramer. Today on our podcast, big tech's big week, Senate hearings, major earnings. Insider's Henry Blodgett says investor confidence probably isn't going anywhere.
All of these companies had what can only be described as staggering performance.
Why COVID cases continue to rise and what Americans should expect for the rest of 2020. Surgeon and staff writer for The New Yorker, Dr. Atul Gawande.
We went from 3/4 of people saying that they were avoiding gatherings indoors with friends and family to now it's under 45% who are avoiding those settings.
Those stories plus confidence in a potential vaccine and sector picks for whoever wins Tuesday's election. It's Friday, October 30th, 2020.
We live in unbelievable times, and 2020, you know what? It's not over yet.
Squawk Pod begins right now.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to Squawk Box here on CNBC. I'm Becky Quick, along with Joe Kernan and Andrew Ross Sorkin. Guys, I will say the momentum this week has been a little concerning, particularly with two stories that jumped out at me. We may talk about this a little later, but the first story was this Reuters Ipsos poll that shows that 4 out of every 10 supporters, both of President Trump and former Vice President Biden, say that they will not accept the results of this election if it goes against the candidate of their choice. And the second was Walmart saying that it's going to be taking guns and ammunition off of its shelves right, because they want to make sure that if there's any civil unrest, if anybody breaks into any of these stores, it's not there for the taking. And those two things together, I think, made me at least sit back and say, wow, where are we?
And each side would point at anecdotal evidence of the other side being capable of it. You know what I mean? I could hear it from each side. I mean, the right would say, look at the cities. The left would say, look at these crazy, you know, Proud Boys or whatever it is. So both sides have something that they could point to where it wouldn't be totally out of the question. And I guess the closer it is, there are people that say the market's been weak, not on either outcome, but on the the closeness now that is seen, that it could be close in the Senate and in the presidency.
The idea that people wouldn't accept the election results, that's the scary thing.
All bets are off in COVID and Donald Trump and everything else in terms of trying to figure out elections and incumbents and markets and everything else. You know, 33%, 34% GDP, all bets are off, but still down a third.
But I think that Walmart's decision yesterday, to me, even beyond just the polling issue of whether people would accept it, suggests that there is a real concern about civil unrest in this country, and at a level that I don't think I had taken into consideration. I think I understood that, psychologically, there are people who are not going to accept the outcome, which is always going to be the case, and it might have been even a bigger case this year. But I don't think that Walmart does these things without doing their diligence, being educated, and clearly suggestions clearly being made to them, I imagine, by officials and security experts and others
people,
who would suggest to them that they should be thinking that way. And
people
that unto itself is scary.
Gunlack used the R word the other day.
Revolution.
I'm not talking about recession. By 2027, I think.
Well, the other thing is Walmart is...
If Trump wins, there's going to be... there are people ready to go that have been out already. I mean, they've got in the past 6 months they've had a full calendar of events and protests. And if he wins, that's definitely going to happen.
The Walmart news caught me more by surprise because when we were watching stores getting broken into during some of that civil unrest over the summer, most of the time it was a Target store. They happen to be in more urban areas than Walmart's. I don't recall seeing Walmart's getting broken into. Maybe I'm forgetting that. But that was kind of the thing that struck me, too, is this is broad. They're everywhere. And I guess I could see the concern and wanting to be safe rather than sorry. But it did make me kind of sit back and really think.
I'd also suggest that, you know, looting is a terrible thing and it should be condemned and is criminal. Most of those looting events didn't seem, there were dangerous protests, obviously, but it wasn't, I mean, the idea that people were going to be, you know, stealing guns to go do real things.
Yeah. There was violence in some of that,
level
those looting
than any
events.
Of the
there
protests.
Were store employees who were under attack.
Right.
So, I was thinking that there's 300 million guns already. So, I mean, you're not going to get any more. And most of the people that have guns have ammunition, more than they'll ever use. So I don't know. I mean, this is a step, but if it's going to hit the fan, there's enough. You know, there's enough already out there. I mean, we live in unbelievable times. And 2020, you know what? It's not over yet. 2020. So I wouldn't take anything off the table.
A rainy day in New York City this morning, and some rain also on some tech stocks, or at least on the tech stock names, though some of the returns came in pretty well. A number of big tech numbers, tech companies reporting quarterly results yesterday. Let's walk through them. Apple beating Wall Street expectations, but didn't offer guidance for the quarter ending in December. And iPhone revenue was down. Maybe that was expected, given, of course, or should have been expected, given the fact that the new phones were coming and people were holding off waiting to see those new phones. Meanwhile, Facebook saw a decline in users in the United States and Canada. Amazon shares falling after what was a blowout quarter, let's be honest. Its projection, though, for the fourth quarter profit margin was lower than analyst expectations, given the gap that they offered there in terms of just how wide it is. And there are a couple other bright spots as well. Here to break it all down is Henry Blodgett, co-founder and CEO of Insider, new owner of Morning Brew. We should congratulate you on that, Henry. And it's nice to see you this morning. Let's walk through some of these stocks. Let's go straight to Apple, if we could, which is to say, were you surprised at the results? And should we be happy? I mean, the results were good results. It's just a matter maybe of expectations here of what's going to happen next.
Yeah, I think stepping back, all of these companies had what can only be described as staggering performance. This year, these companies are gradually, quarter after quarter, swallowing the world, continuing to grow at rates that would have been unthinkable for companies of this size 10 or 20 years ago. And yes, I think you can poke it at each quarter and say, here, something was wrong here, something's wrong there. And certainly the stocks are expensive, as we've talked about every time. Most of them are in the low 30s in terms of PE. That's a high PE, you know, could be less than that. But overall, fundamentally, the companies are still in amazing shape. And I think what's happening is there's always a lot of noise around the quarter, and I'll leave to your guests who are a lot smarter than I am about the interim trading on that. But overall, the fundamentals are great. The market itself is expensive. COVID is resurging. That's not good news for anybody. So I think that's playing a role as well.
Henry, let me ask you, though, a question about Apple. And this is a tweet from Charlie Bilello. Apple revenue was up 1% over the past year. Its stock is up 92% in the past year. What gives?
Well, we've seen tremendous multiple inflation across this sector. And part of it is that investors are recognizing the truth, which is, again, the fundamentals of these companies have just been extraordinary. And Apple, a little bit less so on the revenue, but they're still rock solid. They're tremendous. The cash flow is amazing. So investors are recognizing that. But at the same time, you know, the multiples are high. We pointed that out. So no one should be surprised to see if we get multiple compression, especially if the market itself is under pressure, which seems like it's possible.
You know, the question is, 10 years from today, is Apple or Amazon going to still be the biggest company in the world?
I would say unlikely, given the way dynamics work in these businesses, but certainly an Amazon is in enough massive businesses that if things continue to go well for them, they could continue to have a great run. But it's fascinating watching oil and energy. From my perspective, know nothing about it, but am struck from a distance as a citizen and watcher of the markets at just how binary the expectations are for these companies. It was 10 years ago, it's going to be peak oil, oil's going to $500 a barrel. Now they're all going to go out of business because we're all going to be on battery power. I think if you step back from it, and renewables, if you step back from it, you know, does the world need energy, and is oil going to continue to be a source of energy for a long time and other things? It seems reasonable. So it's just fascinating to watch investors trade around these.
Are you betting, by the way, on the big tech companies, and this goes to the issue of whether we'll be talking about them 10 years ago as the biggest companies in the world, that they are going to ultimately get broken up? I mean, we've been talking, obviously, about Google, which was in the news with their earnings. Blowout, by the way, on YouTube. But a lot of people have suggested, for example, that YouTube will get spun off as part, either because the government will force it or because people will think it's a business imperative.
I think there is going to be more regulation of these companies. You can't have this concentration of power without leading to that. And I think the point we've made before on this, is it's going to take a long time to figure out. It's incredibly complicated. The companies make the argument that is a good argument in a lot of cases, that what they are doing is improving the consumer experience and making it better and better. And is it better for the consumer if YouTube and the search engine Google are spun apart? I don't know why it would be necessarily. It's certainly better for competition, I suppose. But I think the key point is that if any of these companies are ever broken up, investors in the companies are going to own both. And the companies will then continue to go do well.
Right.
YouTube is not just doing well because it's a part of Google. It is doing well because it's an absolute juggernaut unto itself. And it will continue to do well, even if the two companies are separated. So I think in general, the regulatory fears are overblown in terms of it being an existential crisis. But I do think it will create uncertainty, and it is going to take a long time for each one of them to work through how you regulate them.
Henry, a broader question just about uncertainty in the markets today. How concerned are you, and how concerned should investors be broadly about the possibility of civil unrest, genuine civil unrest, over the next several weeks? Walmart is effectively taking guns and ammo out of their stores, frankly, out of genuine worry and concern. There could be looting and the like, and people, you know, robbing these stores, taking this stuff and taking to the streets. That is really concerning, because I don't think that they would make such a move lightly unless they were hearing from officials who were offering them intelligence about this kind of potential.
I think, unfortunately, it is reasonable to be concerned about it. I think the hope of every American is that if there is anything like that, it will be very short-lived and brought under control and calmed down quickly. But I just think it's such a sad state, or sad commentary on the state of the country, that we have to worry about that. We have been a wedge has been driven in this country between the two, you know, massive groups who see things incredibly differently. And I think that it would be wonderful if we could remember that we have a lot more in common than differences, and begin to think of ourselves as Americans again together. And that would be great for business, by the way. The uncertainty doesn't help.
That's a great message in the broadest sense. As an investor, though, for those who are watching, investing in the markets, what do you do?
Well, I think it's tough. I think high level, the markets are expensive, and that is a big concern. And the folks who say it's fine, it's liquidity driven, the Fed will be back with more, and there'll be more stimulus from Congress and so forth, so it's going to continue. They may be right. The recovery since the bottom in March has been incredible. Maybe that continues. But I think that longer term, leaving aside the current expensiveness and so forth, markets have come through wars many times. They have come through centuries. There are a couple of examples of markets that have effectively gone to zero when you have had a complete change of the government system in a country. But otherwise, markets have come through even periods that have been much, much worse and more divisive than the one we have, and gone on to do well. So long term, knock on wood, we should be okay.
Okay. Henry Blodgett, nice to see you. Appreciate it.
Great to see you.
Thanks,
Henry.
Again.
Investors are working overtime trying to figure out how to position their money ahead of the election and for a number of possible results. I almost started laughing, Dom. Dom Chu joins us now with more. Even if you knew, this is classic, because we have no idea on the election, really. Senate, Biden, Trump, so that's tough enough. Even if you did know, you have no idea what the market's going to do in relation to what you think you know. So you could be right about the election, wrong about the market's reaction, wrong about the election, and be right in spite of yourself. There's so many, it's like four-dimensional chess. So I don't envy you trying to come up with, maybe, I think you could buy solar, maybe, and renewable stuff if you think Biden's going to win. Maybe that would, maybe sectors you could do. But overall market stuff, seems very, very difficult.
No, I mean, there's a whole point. Remember the dartboard
healthcare
approach back in the day? And you just throw darts at the Wall Street Journal and pick which ticker comes up. Nobody knows exactly what's going to happen, but you're right. There are certain themes that develop, right, Joe? There's certain things that you can say, hey, maybe if there's more spending on infrastructure, these types of stocks do well, that sort of thing. So what we did, Joe, the folks over at CNBC Pro, which is our subscription premium service here. I should give a shout out there because this is a story that's on CNBC Pro right now. What we looked at, the team there, they looked at analyst reports from like Barclays, Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, Cowen, UBS, Credit Suisse, you name them. We kind of looked at them. We tried to put them all and distill them into certain themes that are happening. We wanted to put some probability numbers, and these are the ones from Raymond James, because everyone's got different ones, Joe, to your point. So in this case here, what happens if there's a blue wave, right? Biden wins the presidency, the Democrats take control of the Senate, they control the House, it's a whole blue thing. What exactly happens? Well, Raymond James says it's a 55% chance, according to them, that that could happen. If that were to happen, Joe, to your point, what sectors do well? Well, it could be financials, industrials, tech, materials, utilities. Meanwhile, those big media and communication services companies don't do as well. Social media perhaps getting targeted more heavily there. That's one possible scenario. Another one is things just stay the same. Raymond James says there is a probability that that happens, but it's more about a 30% chance. If that were to happen and President Trump stays in the White House and the Republicans continue to control the Senate, but the Democrats control the House, you'll see comm services do relatively better, energy do relatively better, industrials do relatively better. Meanwhile, technology and materials do worse in those scenarios. And then there's another scenario that's not as likely, but it's a 10% chance that maybe we see Vice President Joe Biden win the presidency, but then you have a Republican-controlled Senate. They say it's a 10% chance. If that were to happen, media comm services does okay relatively well. Energy doesn't do as well. Retail doesn't do as well, but tech does better. You get the idea. The point here is that there are so many different scenarios to play out, which is why many of them are saying look longer term. And again, the rest of this story is on CNBC Pro right now. I guess, Andrew, my question to you guys is, have you guys talked about the Buskin Bakery in Cincinnati, Ohio? Their cookie sales have predicted.
No.
Their cookie sales have predicted the last nine presidential winners.
Right.
And right now
Trump.
It's saying Trump.
Joe,
right now it's saying Trump.
Trump.
So
as when Joe is a Cincinnati boy, have you eaten these cookies?
When he said Buskin, I jumped. I haven't eaten the cookies, but when he said Buskin, I jumped a little because I was like, "Wow, are you going to Cincinnati? There's Graders, there's Buskin, there's Skyline, there's certain there's Montgomery and Ribs, there's certain things that Sarah." Can confirm. But yeah, the cookie thing, Cincinnati.
Nine winners predicted.
Cincinnati is, last time I was back there, I will tell you, I was at the Montgomery Inn and I had 10 people come up for ribs. I had 10 people come up and say, don't believe the polls. Do not believe the polls. So, and they were right. I don't know. Cincinnati, though, I think in all of Ohio, that's about as conservative as you get, Dom. You know that. So I don't know whether we can read anything into that for Buskin Bakery. But you can't win Ohio. If you don't win Ohio and Florida, I think you're going to go home.
So here's the thing, Joe. Remember, it may be more conservative, but those cookies also picked Obama twice, right?
So that's weird.
It is weird, right? Just saying.
Yeah, that's weird. Although Ohio went for Obama both times, and Ohio went for, didn't go for Romney. I mean, Romney, that was, Missouri, I think, was the only state. Poor Mitt. I saw I was listening to him. We got to go. Andrew, see you later, Dom. Thanks.
See you guys.
I was listening to some indie rock yesterday. The group's name was Rit Romney. And I said, now that's interesting that they decided to pick their name. Rit Romney. They look them up. They're pretty good. Pretty good.
Co-journey.
Next on Squawk Pod, when there's a COVID vaccine, will you trust it? Navigating the next stage of the pandemic with Dr. Atul Gawande, New Yorker staff writer and surgeon.
In these early stages, the worry to me is less that there won't be enough people to take it. The worry is having enough doses.
We'll be right back. This is Squawk Pod with Joe Kernan, Becky Quick, and Andrew Ross Sorkin. Here's Joe.
As the race for vaccine heats up, our CNBC All America survey asked Americans if they trust Big Pharma. to deliver. Steve Leisman joins us now with the details. Hey, Steve.
Good morning, Joe. Yeah, the CNBC All-America Economic Survey finding that only a bare majority of Americans trust Big Pharma to wait to deliver a vaccine until it's safe and effective. The concerns of key demographic groups create a potential roadblock towards widespread vaccination and adoption of the vaccine. Just 53% of the 800 Americans we surveyed say pharmaceutical companies will only make a vaccine available when safe and effective. 39%, they're concerned that the industry will rush due to political pressure or to profits. Breaking that down, 20% say their concern is that companies are motivated by profits. 12% worried they'll rush because of, profits. The next one is politics, because of politics. 7% say both. Now, looking at it, one big split that's in there along party lines. 62% of Republicans trust Big Pharma when it comes to a vaccine versus just 47% of Democrats. Independents, they match the concern of Democrats. But another big split that's out there, women age 18 to 49 are among the most skeptical groups when it comes to a coronavirus vaccine. And that's a critical group when it comes to a family's decision about whether or not to take the vaccine. And what's more interesting here is that the differences don't really show up when we ask generally whether the public trusts the pharmaceutical industry. You can see here that the pharmaceutical industry is about average when it comes to the public's trust in a specific industry. 28% say they trust the industry quite a bit or a great deal. Less than online retailers, about even with the financial industry, but above the national news media. Social media, you could see right there. Well, they're in the doghouse with the American public. Also, the big takeaway here, I think, is that politicians, government agencies, and industry, they have a lot of work to do to convince the public about the safety of a vaccine and the approval process. And that would appear to be true, no matter who wins the election. Becky?
Hey, Steve, I think that number among 18 to 49-year-old women, that almost 60% of them think that this is going to be motivated by politics or by profits, that to me is the most stunning number. Did they ask specifically on the poll, does this mean they won't take the vaccine, or they have concerns about this, but they might take the vaccine anyway? Because if that's the case, we might as well just write it off. Even if a vaccine's developed, it's not going to make any difference if you get almost 60% of women who are making the decisions about their families and whether they'll get these vaccines.
The answer is we did not ask that particular follow-up question, Becky. Getting down to that level of detail on the profits versus politics was about what we could do on this. And whether that translates into not taking the vaccine, that's a different question that we'll ask in a follow-up question. Others have asked it, and there is widespread reluctance in the public about taking the vaccine. This R53% number for the general public is, in fact, even a little bit higher than findings by Pew and findings by Gallup, which are in the 51%. What we wanted to do, what others are not doing, is drill down and see to the extent to which what the cause of that concern is. Is it politics? Is it profits? And then which groups have it? And we were able to do that and then compare that with overall trust in the industry, which is not that bad. There's not a whole lot of trust in industry among the public in general. But we're able to find that the problem is not the concern about the pharmaceutical industry in general. It's all of the talk that's out there. And what we saw is that comments by President Trump moved Democrats more forcefully into the ones who were concerned about it, if you look at some of the trend in the other polls. But yeah, we'll follow up with that in the future as to whether or not that translates into actual reluctance in taking the vaccine.
Was any industry over 50%, Steve? The only ones I...
No.
I think 38
no.
was the high... What's going... Yeah, okay, so then how about government? That's probably 20%. So we are just a cynical group of people in this country right now, are we not? Is there anything at the majority of... who is trusted then at this point? Maybe healthcare workers or something. That's not really an industry.
We used to find that the Army was trusted, Joe. The U.S. Army was trusted. Military in general.
I trust those guys. I trust
Supreme Court numbers.
I'm a way above on those things. We've just been hammered by too much I don't know, Steve. That's depressing to me.
Nobody likes anybody right now.
I know. Yeah,
nobody likes me. Everybody hates me. I'm going to eat some worms.
I like you guys.
I like
anyway,
you. I like Steve. I like everybody. Mac. Everybody.
It's a kumbaya morning.
Big world. Yeah. Steve, thank you. We're going to check in with you again, but let's get some more insight on this. Joining us right now with more on the vaccine chase and the future of healthcare in America is Dr. Atul Gawande. He's a staff writer for The New Yorker. He's also a surgeon at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston and a professor at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. His latest piece in The New Yorker argues that controlling the pandemic is the first step toward rescuing a failed system. Doctor, it's good to see you this morning. And before we jump into your latest article, let's talk a little bit about what Steve was just telling us, this idea that there's not a lot of trust out there, either with politics or with the profit incentive motivating the pharmaceuticals for these vaccines. And as a result, you got to wonder how many people will actually take the vaccines.
Well, a couple of things. There is actually very strong trust in national surveys in healthcare institutions, in doctors, and even with the polarization around scientists, in scientists. So I think the critical thing is that the approval process follow the science. And I think the FDA has now asserted its independence and indicated very transparently what their public process will be, what the evidence will be they'll need to see. I'm more concerned about a couple of things that, you know, as a vaccine comes to approval, it will be healthcare workers who will first get it. And the willingness of healthcare workers to get the vaccine will help engender trust. However, what we see is Moderna announced that they will have about 10 million courses of vaccine. Pfizer might have up to 20 million courses of vaccine. If one of them work, that means we'll have enough for 10 to 20 million people. We have 20 million high-risk healthcare workers and first responders. There won't even be enough for that group, let alone getting to the second group, which would be the elderly in nursing homes, people in very high-risk settings. So in these early stages, the worry to me is less that there won't be enough people to take it. The worry is having enough doses. It will be months until we have enough to get to the next level groups where we're worrying about that lower risk demographic taking vaccines.
That's what we heard from Ken Frazier from Merck yesterday, that it's going to be months before we get to that point. But we've also heard from Dr. Scott Gottlieb that it's probably the next 2 to 3 months that are most critical, because that's the time where you're going to see an increase in cases. You've got the flu potentially being confused with some of these things. And maybe once we get through to the spring, at least we hope the caseload will come back down. There will have been more people exposed to it. People will perhaps be behaving a little more safely. What do you think of that?
I think Dr. Gottlieb is exactly right. The next 2-3 months, I mean, the wave we're in right now, we're at 500,000 new cases per week. It took just 2 weeks to jump from 8 million to 9 million cases. Hospitalizations are up. Deaths are up. Wisconsin yesterday hit an all-time record high, a single-day high for cases, deaths, and hospitalization all on the same day. So, you know, these next 2-3 months are absolutely critical, and we can control it. The alarming thing is how many states are deciding it can't be done, pushed by a White House that has said, you know, they're not going to roll out a national testing strategy. We know what needs to be done. In hospitals, we actually have learned how to control it, and it's just extending that elsewhere. Those are, as we always talk about, the masks, being able to socially distance, and really avoid crowded indoor spaces. That's the big thing that has changed. We went from 3/4 of people saying that they were avoiding gatherings indoors with friends and family, to now it's under 45%. Who are avoiding those settings. And that's where a great deal of spread is happening. Finally, I'll say, if you look around at the current rates we're seeing of infection, if you come into contact with large groups of people, there's a high likelihood someone in that group has been infected and will spread to you, especially in indoor settings, and especially if people are not wearing masks.
So, Atul, how much of this is a behavioral science question at this point? Just people fatigued and just deciding they're going to go inside and have dinner with friends, and that's the problem? Or how much of it is that we still don't have enough N95 masks, something you've been calling for since the very beginning, which would probably be the cheapest way to change the dynamic? Though I don't know if friends are going to sit inside with their N95 masks on. And then, of course, there's still testing. And what needs to happen on a national testing scale, because it feels like all of the momentum and emphasis has now been on therapeutics and vaccines to the detriment of testing and the question of whether we'll even need the testing in the future. Some people think we will. Some people think we won't.
Well, so let's break it down. You started going through those nicely. Masks. We no longer have a shortage of surgical masks, and surgical masks are more effective than cloth masks. I would strongly suggest that people go ahead and order, get your surgical masks. They're better than the cloth masks. They're also more breathable and easy to use. The 91% of Americans now report that they are wearing masks. So we're starting to be a lot better. The key issue is that then we take them off when we go to restaurants or other indoor settings, or we have high risk groups who really are just do not want to wear the masks and attend large group functions where things can spread. We can do better on that front. Testing. Testing has become more available, but as cases climb, we're running back into that situation where the turnaround times on tests are getting longer and it's getting harder to get the tests. Case in point would be North Dakota and South Dakota. I mean, in North Dakota, you have now the test positivity rate over 43%, which means that even with 100 cases per 100,000 people, which is some of the highest spread rates in the world, we're still not even capturing a fraction of the cases that are out there. We need much more testing. And that means investment, telling all of the labs around the country, order your reagents now for December and January, hire those workers. We are going to use those tests, and we are not sending that signal. A lot of my work has been around building logistics and operations to tap into all of that untapped capacity. And we can triple, quadruple the amount of testing capacity within the next few weeks if we can make that commitment, where we haven't done that. And then finally, it's investing in the tracing.
Who has to do that?
Yeah. That is without question. The administration can do that through Operation Warp Speed. They have cash on hand. And then it's Congress, which needs to add on additional dollars. But Warp Speed has dollars for not just vaccines, but for therapeutics and for testing. And deploying more of those dollars to the states is going to be critical.
Dr. Gawande, I wanted to thank you for your time this morning. We will check in with you again, but we appreciate it.
Absolutely.
Squawk Pod will be right back. That's Squawk Pod for today and for another week. Thanks for listening to this podcast whenever you do. Squawk Box is hosted by Joe Kernan, Becky Quick, and Andrew Ross Sorkin. Tune in weekday mornings on CNBC at 6 a.m. Eastern. Subscribe to Squawk Pod. Thoughts, questions, tweet us anytime at Squawk CNBC. We'll meet you back here on Monday. Have a good weekend. And if 2020 isn't scary enough for you, happy Halloween.